Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this very day back in 1996 that Jerry Garcia's remaining ashes were scattered near the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, California. Where had the initial portion of his ashes been spread earlier this same month, back in 1996? Was it A, Strawberry Fields in Central Park, Manhattan? Was it B, the Ganges River in India? Was it C, Soldier Field in Chicago, Illinois, or was it D, Bourbon Street, New Orleans, Louisiana? And question number two, it was on this day back in 1967 that the duet Something Stupid hit number one on the U.S. singles chart. It was the first father and daughter act to ever hit number one. Who was the father and daughter in this act? Was it A, Billy Ray and Miley Cyrus? Was it B, Nancy and Frank Sinatra? Was it C, Wendy and Brian Wilson? Or was it D, Natalie and Nat King Cole? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of April the 13th. Well, it was on this day, back in 1742, that George Frederick Handel's Messiah was first performed publicly in Dublin, Ireland. And also on this day, 17 years after that, 1759, that Handel died. And it was 60 years ago today, 1958, that Van Cliburn of Kilgore, Texas, earned first prize in the Soviet Union's Tchaikovsky International Piano Contest in Moscow. He was the first American to ever win the award. And in bluegrass, folk, and country music news, we have this article written by Alex Susskind, and it's published in Entertainment Weekly, April 13th, 2018 issue, entitled Golden Girl. Kacey Musgraves fans are in for a surprise. Her new LP, the spectacular Golden Hour, mixes the singer's trademark twang with a touch of outer space. She told EW about the inspirations behind her colorful new sound. Number one, I went on a fun trip and ended up writing the song Mother. I got really tripped out thinking about my mom. She actually texted when I was tripping, and it made me nostalgic and emotional. I started thinking about the cycle of moms in life. I just got super heady about it, and I wrote it all down. And the next day, I finished the song. The trip, it inspired me, and it ended up being a mainstay inspiration on the album. Number two, Currents by Tame Impala. I fell in love with the record Currents hard. It just feels good to listen to. There was this storytelling-like quality at moments that, along with the melty, synthy ear candy, made it a huge impression on me, and I was excited at infusing that sound into country music. Number 3, the solar eclipse. We were in the middle of making the album when the total solar eclipse happened and darkened all of Nashville. It was also my birthday. It just felt like a time to be present and witness and take in what was happening around me. It's my 29th year, the golden hour, so to speak, of my 20s, and I don't know. It was just this special moment, and it felt really cosmic. It added into the Zen nature of where I'm at. Number 4, disco. I was listening to a ton of Bee Gees while making this album. I feel like disco is back, and I kept envisioning this Western disco kind of thing. A mashup of those styles is fun to play with. Number 5, Sade. I grew up listening to her. I feel like her musical sensibilities are imprinted on me somewhere, subconsciously. I appreciate the fact that she's an artist who makes no apologies or concessions to anyone. And number 6, marriage. Getting married, that's a big one. My world just completely changed. I met my now husband, singer Rustin Kelly, around the time that I set off on a new creative journey. And songs, like Butterflies, just started coming out of me. I hear a lot of songwriters say, I'm happy now, I can't write anymore. And I don't really understand that. I want to write about everything. I don't just want to write sad songs. So naturally, that new chapter brought out new sounds. And finally, number 7, Sheryl Crow. We got to record at Sheryl Crow's house. She's got a recording studio that's also a horse stable. I'm a horse lover. I have one myself. I just feel a peace and calmness around horses. Maybe it's through a little osmosis, but there are some early Sheryl Crow vibes on this album. And the April 13, 2018 issue of The Week magazine, by the way, gives Casey's new album 4 out of a possible 4 stars. And it says, the new Casey Musgraves record might be 2018's best album so far, says Mav McDermott in USA Today. A wondrous collection of songs that finds the 29-year-old newlywed in a perpetual swoon, not just over love, but the entire world that surrounds her new life. It disproves the fact that all great art, or at least all great country music, emerges from heartbreak. Musgraves, a Texas-bred singer-songwriter who broke boundaries on her Grammy-winning 2013 debut, still speaks her mind. If she's feeling magical, she's going to say so. Musgraves describes Golden Hour as galactic country, and the music is surely her spaciest yet, awash in synthesizers and merely accented by pedal steel guitar. Listening to the record, you might zone out for whole songs at a time, only to find yourself startled by some pristine detail, like the banjo that delicately pushes, Oh, What a World, heavenward. And in classical music news, we have this upcoming concert, Brahms Symphony No. 4. That's coming up this Friday and Saturday, April 13th and 14th, 2018 at 8 p.m. David Dansmeyer, conductor. Angelo Ziang Yu on violin. Playing Sarah Kirkland Snyder's Something for the Dark. Prokofiev's Violin Concerto No. 2. And, of course, Brahms Symphony No. 4. And this has been Brahms Symphony No. 3, playing in the background right now. Also in classical news, why are orchestras arranged the way they are? This is written by Maddie Shaw Robert, ClassicFM.com on the 19th of February, 2018. How come the flutes are always hidden behind the violins? And why can't the tuba sit right next to the conductor and soak up a bit of the orchestral limelight, which is totally snapped up by the strings anyway? When we think of the traditional layout of an orchestra, we think of the violins directly to the left of the conductor, and the violas in the center, with the woodwind and then the percussion behind them. Then the cellos and double basses are usually placed to the right of the conductor, with the brass section behind them. Loud wind together at the back, quieter strings together at the front. Seems logical, right? Well, until around 100 years ago, this format did not exist. In fact, the second violins used to be seated opposite the first violins, where the cellos normally are. This seating plan helped support the antiphonal or conversational effect in the strings, which 18th and 19th century composers like Mozart, Elgar, and Mahler often wrote into their music. Listen out for it in the finale to Mozart's Symphony No. 41, Jupiter. But then in the early mid-20th century, Leopold Stokowski came along and changed the game. Best known for conducting the Philadelphia Orchestra, Stokowski thought the previous layout didn't provide the best sound projection, so he radically experimented with different seating plans. On one occasion, he horrified Philadelphians by placing the winds and brass in front of the strings, says Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. The board was outraged, arguing that the winds weren't busy enough to put on a good show. But in the 1920s, he made one change that stuck. He arranged the strings from high to low, left to right, arguing that placing all the violins together helped the musicians to hear one another better. The Stokowski shift, as it became known, was adopted by orchestras all over America. With regard to volume, it makes sense to put all the violins together at the front. An orchestra has 20 violins and 2 tubas because tubas are a lot louder than violins. So with the same logic, violins should also be put at the front so they can be heard. There's also something to be said for the visual beauty of putting violins at the front. The sweeping motion of 20 violin bows moving together in unison is rather pretty, and you could argue it would be a shame to change that. But after years of watching pretty unified violins, is it time conductors channeled their inner Stokowski and changed up the seating plan again? Then perhaps the tubas could finally enjoy some time in the spotlight. Just don't forget to bring your earplugs. And in jazz music news, we have this review published in the Week magazine, 13th of April 2018 issue of the album by Miles Davis and John Coltrane. It's called The Final Tour, and it's given 4 out of a possible 4 stars. The new Miles Davis-John Coltrane box set demands we revise the conventional wisdom about these two musicians, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Davis, known as a master shapeshifter, was resistant to the free jazz revolution Coltrane was attempting when the tenor saxophonist and longtime sideman in Davis's quintet grudgingly agreed to a 1960 European tour to promote the trumpeter's kind of blue. Throughout the 5 concerts on this 4-disc collection, Volume 6 of the Miles Davis bootleg series, Coltrane strains against musical barriers. Even on the opening tune, Cole Porter's All of You, the soloing reed man unleashes volcanoes of notes, layering chords upon chords. At the time, no one had heard anything like this before, and Davis pushed back, both on stage and off. Not every performance is as tempestuous, said David Weininger in the Boston Globe, but for 4 discs and 5 nights, the tension between Train's explosiveness and Miles' painterly restraint is so palatable that it begins to function as the ensemble's sixth member. And this has been Miles Davis performing Blue in Green in the background right now. You may also be aware that the signature opening track to this program, Angelica, is performed by John Coltrane and Duke Ellington. And in music research and technology, we have this article written by David Menconi, published in the News and Observer on the 1st of April, 2018, entitled, There's More Than Just Us Who Needs to Hear This. This is the story behind the autism song. Usually a song like Johnny Orr Band's We'll Get By, the autism song, begins with an artist's personal connection to someone who has the condition. But Orr's song is an exception. At the time he wrote and recorded We'll Get By, the 48-year-old Wake Forest resident didn't really know anyone with autism. A range of conditions related to difficulties in communicating and relating to people. But that didn't matter. The song, released in April 2014 for Autism Awareness Month, has resonated with families, those who know people on the autism spectrum, and people who are autistic themselves. The video has almost 884,000 views on YouTube, and Orr has played it at gatherings of all sizes and on national television. At times, Orr and the audience will find themselves in tears at the end, and around this time every year, We'll Get By finds new listeners who connect with the song in a deeply personal way. I've since met hundreds and hundreds of people from all over the world with autism, all different sides and spectrums, Orr said. A lot of people with autism don't like to be touched or hugged, but several have embraced me because of the song. It's amazing to me the things kids and adults have to deal with because of this. Orr did the song for hire, commissioned by TV radio personality Candy Spitz and her husband Dan Spitz, the former guitarist in the metal band Anthrax. She had wanted to use it for her show, Orr recalled, but they called me crying after hearing it. There's more than just us who needs to hear this. Candy and Dan, who were raising twin sons who are autistic and nonverbal at the time. Their sons were nonverbal, just motions and movements and blinks, Orr said. So they'd never been able to tell their mom, I love you. Based on conversations and emails from the parents, Orr wrote, We'll Get By, from the perspective of an autistic child, as evidenced in these lyrics. If you'll wait patiently, well then, eventually, I will understand the words that you're saying to me. My autism is like a prison that I'm in. I wrote it from the first-person standpoint of a child being able to say things to mom and letting her know. I see what you go through, he said. Orr describes himself as a current country artist with some rock and roll roots. Commissioned songs are a sideline, and he's written a lot of them in celebration of weddings, anniversaries, birthdays, holidays, and other happy occasions. He's also been commissioned to write somber, issue-oriented songs about subjects including homelessness, domestic violence, and terminal illness. Another of his better-known commissioned songs is Superman, which started out as a request to write a song about cancer. I made it more of a blanket song about someone who is terminal or elderly on their way to passing to glory, with the family making last gestures and reconnections, Orr said. I had started but not finished it when I had a friend pass due to a car accident. She was in the hospital in a coma, and I'd visit. And I wrote the song about how I wished I was Superman and could fly her all over the world to see her friends and things one last time. That's probably the other most important song to me, he said. I get a lot of requests for it. I sang Superman and a Vince Gill song at a funeral the other day, right there at graveside. As for what Orr charges to write a song like this for hire, the price varies from project to project. It's generally anywhere from a few $100 up to $1,000 or more, and sometimes it's determined by how much the topic moves him. The price depends on how much they ask me to do, but also if I'm inspired, he said. If someone told me their budget was $200 and it was important enough and I felt strongly about it, I'd probably do it if I was inspired. If I feel a connection or a weird pull to do it, we'll work it out. And in local music news, we have this entitled Art in the Garden 2018. That's coming up on May the 12th, 2018, in the Raleigh Little Theater Rose Garden, general admission. Join us for the annual Arts Festival benefiting Raleigh Little Theater, featuring a jury-selected lineup of artists, food trucks, and live entertainment. This unique outdoor event takes place in the historic Raleigh Rose Garden on the grounds of RLT. Saturday, May the 12th, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., Raleigh Rose Garden on the campus of RLT. Rain date Sunday, May the 13th at the same time. This is sponsored by Witherspoon Rose Culture. Join us for live demonstrations on gardening techniques by Witherspoon's rose experts throughout the day. A few acoustic acts will play 30-minute sets throughout the day in the Rose Garden Shelter as well. And this has been Vetiver performing Farther On in the background right now.
There's no one gonna tell me how to feel. Not for my sake, Tom, for the family.
So, how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our second question, it was on this day back in 1967 that the duet Something Stupid hit number one on the U.S. singles chart. It was the first father and daughter act to ever hit number one. Who was the father and daughter in this act? Was it A, Billy Ray and Miley Cyrus? Was it B, Nancy and Frank Sinatra? Was it C, Wendy and Brian Wilson? Or was it D, Natalie and Nat King Cole? Well, all of these are father and daughter acts, but the correct answer here is answer B, Nancy and Frank Sinatra. Their single, Something Stupid, hit number one on the U.S. singles chart on this very day back in 1967. And it was the very first father and daughter act to hit number one. And the answer to our first question, it was on this day back in 1996 that Jerry Garcia's remaining ashes were scattered near the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, California. Where had the initial portion of his ashes been spread back earlier in April 1996? Was it A, Strawberry Fields, Central Park, Manhattan? Was it B, the Ganges River in India? Was it C, Soldier Field in Chicago, Illinois? Or D, Bourbon Street, New Orleans, Louisiana? Well, each of these is relevant, but the correct answer is answer B, the Ganges River in India. As noted in thecapitaltheater.com on August the 7th, 2015, Jerry Garcia passed away on August the 9th, 1995, at just 53 years old. Over the years, friends, family, and fellow deadheads have flocked to different places to pay tribute to their fallen leader. Here are some places you can go to remember his life, legacy, and death, including 710 Ashbury Street, San Francisco. This small Victorian house in San Francisco's iconic Haight-Ashbury district was home to the Grateful Dead from 1966 through 1968. Then there is Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. After his death, Jerry Garcia was cremated and his ashes were split and scattered in two locations that he held sacred, one being underneath San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge. While Jerry never visited India during his lifetime, the other half of his ashes were scattered into the famous Ganges River near the town of Rishikesh after a lunar eclipse. The cremation was performed in secret by Garcia's widow, Deborah, and his bandmate, Bob Weir, who feared publicizing the event would lead to a crowd. Soldier Field in Chicago, well, that's where Jerry Garcia played his final show on July 9, 1995. Garcia closed out his final concert with an encore of Black Muddy River and Box of Rain. Strawberry Fields in Manhattan, located in Central Park, this is a memorial dedicated to John Lennon. Shortly after news of Jerry Garcia's death, about 1,000 deadheads gathered together to leave roses and sing songs in the late singer's memory at this spot. Then there's Serenity Knowles, Forest Knowles, California. This drug rehabilitation facility is where Jerry Garcia spent the last few days leading up to his death. He passed away due to heart failure while seeking treatment at that center. The center offers beautiful grounds to walk and contemplate Jerry's life. Finally, there's Bourbon Street in Orleans. This legendary New Orleans party district was the site of an infamous drug bust in which several band members were arrested, along with various members of the band's touring entourage. The incident is now immortalized in the song Truckin', as heard through the lyrics, "Busted down on Bourbon Street." So in honor of the anniversary of Jerry Garcia's cremation, let's close out today's program with the Grateful Dead's Truckin'.
Busted down on Bourbon Street, set up like a falling pin, knocked down, it gets to wear it thin, it just won't let you be.
Sick of hanging around you like a travel. Get tired of traveling, you want to settle down.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.
Catch my bones and get that truckin' on.